This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Fighting Through Podcast, Episode 92, The 82nd Airborne, Letters from Sicily, featuring Dave Thomas. More great unpublished history. Two Germans bolted out of the house and were quickly shot. Fred pulled a pin on a grenade to throw into the house. For some reason, he paused, but one of his guys said, "Throw it, Sarge." The paratroopers of the 504th crossed over the Sicilian coast on schedule. Despite extensive precautions to avoid an incident, a nervous Allied naval vessel suddenly fired upon the formation. My dad was on one of the first planes in the invasion, and only half of the guys made it out before the plane went down. The field hospital was hell on earth, screaming, wounded men, and the nurses were ankle deep in mud, blood, and bandages.
One of our Normandy vets, he was a dispatch rider, and he went down this road. He nearly bumped into a Tiger tank that was coming the other way.
Hello again, and another scorching hot World War II welcome to the Fighting Through Second World War podcast. I'm Paul Cheel, son of Bill Cheel, whose World War II memoirs have been published by Pen and Sword in Fighting Through from Dunkirk to Hamburg. The aim of this podcast is to read family stories, memoirs and interviews with veterans in all the countries and all the forces. I dare you to listen. Just to kick off the show, I'd like to say thank you to the several listeners who inquired about my welfare and, by implication, the somewhat tardy appearance of this episode. Dave Edgerton and Lisa Loftus, amongst others, asked if everything was okay, and it is. I'm absolutely fine. Thank you for your concern. I'm just late. Dave, while he was on it, set a good example in supporting the show recently. He only went and joined the Facebook page and set about going through every single post, giving each and every one a like. Many thanks indeed for your support, Dave, good man. I've got some cracking material to share with you, so I'll push on. I've got an interview with Claire and Steve from the Soldiers Charity about a very special Normandy tour you might wish to join later this year. I've got a great family story from Dave Thomas about his father's exploits in the 82nd Airborne. And I've got yet another interview with veteran Ken Cook, who has got some more tidbits to share with us about his time in Normandy, with an absolutely superb explanation about what it was like fighting in the French bocage. Oof, my word. A quick bit of news. I know when I need to search for a particular episode on the website, it can be a trial to find it, particularly if it's an early one. Well, I've just added an episode shortlist to the menu, and if you're looking for a particular episode number, hit the episode shortlist link in the top menu on the website to see a straight listing which will just take you directly to the episode number you want. So that's episode shortlist that you're looking for. Claire Taylor wrote in recently. She said, I'm from the National Events team at ABF, the Soldiers Charity. We're the national charity of the British Army and have been supporting the military family since our formation in 1944. I organise a World War I and World War II commemorative event, which involves walking 100 kilometres over the battlefields of either the Western Front or Normandy beaches. It's an absolutely brilliant event, which passes various points of interest and commemorates many of the incredible individuals and regiments who fought in the World Wars. I'm in the process of organising our 2023 event, and I was hoping I could promote the event on your podcast. I think the walk may be of interest to some of your listeners, and all the money raised goes towards supporting the Army community. That's Claire Taylor, Events Executive. Well, Claire was really only after a shout-out in the podcast, but I thought there was enough in what she said that it would be nice to get her on for an interview rather than me just rambling on from some script. So we sorted out a Zoom meeting with her and her boss, Steve Oatley, and this is the result. Hello, Steve. Thanks for joining the Fighting Through podcast.
Hello, Paul. Nice to meet you.
And hello, Claire. Thank you for joining the Fighting Through podcast.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure, Claire. Right. Steve, what kicked the ball rolling? Just give me the background about your charity and when, you know, why it started and how long you've been going, etc. Just a quick summary.
Yes, sure. So ABF, the Soldiers Charity, was formed in 1944. We were formed as the Army Benevolent Fund. Many people still know us by that name. And essentially, as they were planning the D-Day landings, the government at the time was also planning for what would happen post-war. There were a number of promises made at the end of the First World War, homes for heroes, jobs for the boys, that sort of thing. And actually, when the great demob happened after the end of the First World War, the infrastructure just wasn't in place to support those people coming home. And they didn't want to make the same mistakes again after the end of the Second World War. So they set up a number of benevolent funds. And obviously, because the army had the largest number of people involved, the Army Benevolent Fund was set up and has become one of the biggest. Essentially, we sit underpinning all of the support for the army veterans and their families. And our role is to make sure that wherever you've served, or if you've been directly affected by service, as many families are, that we are that backbone of support to make sure you're okay. So we do that in a couple of different ways. We work with regiments and corps. We work with delivery partners in order to make sure that they have the funding and the systems in place to support people in need.
What's the total number of people you help in any one year?
Yeah, so last year we directly supported 65,000 people.
Wow.
And that is through some of our delivery partners. So, for example, there's a number of military care homes we support, it really is across the whole gamut of support for people, whether that's retraining, whether that's education, whether that's mobility, whether that's elderly care or family support. Yeah. Whatever the need is, we're there to help them.
So it's not just current serving soldiers, it's, if anything, past serving soldiers as well.
Absolutely. Yes, if you've served a day in the army or a 35-year full career, we are your charity. We're here to help you and your families.
I was looking at your website, and you seem to have a phenomenal number of different activities you undertake to raise funds. Well, give me a few examples of those.
Yes, we've got quite a big program throughout the year. We've tried to build our events based on the values of a modern British soldier. So the idea is that each of our events really showcases the incredible work and the incredible values that our soldiers have. So we have an event called the Cateran Yomp, which is a 54-mile walk in the Highlands of Scotland. You got to do that in 24 hours. That's very much around fitness and teamwork and resilience and perseverance. We do an event in the Guildhall in the centre of London called the Lord Mayor's Big Curry Lunch. That's very much around the pageantry. You know, we have a royal guest there. There's lots of senior generals. It's, you know, that yeah. sort of pageantry of the army. We have an event called Operation Bletchley, which is a code-breaking challenge. So you have to, it's one of those virtual events where you have to walk 50 miles in the month of July, and every 5 miles you get a code. So you become a secret agent in the Second World War.
Wow.
And you meet code breakers along the way who give you codes to crack.
Yeah.
And you have to crack those codes and they add up to a message. And you've got to decrypt the message before the end of the month. So that's right. Obviously around the intelligence side of things, the signals, yes. That incredible history that the army have in intelligence and often the difference that makes on the battlefield.
And what's the total income you generate in a year to fund your activities?
Yes, so last year we were around £12 million.
Wow.
It really is amazing support that we get from a whole range of people. Taking part in these events or making a regular gift or leaving a gift in their will, all these elements really help. It's making sure that the Soldiers Charity is there for soldiers that are 16, 17 years old now.
Yeah.
It's our role to be there when they're in their 80s and 90s. So it very much is looking at the long haul.
That's excellent. It really is. We may come back to one or two things, but I'll turn to Claire now because I want to ask her about your forthcoming event, because it was Claire that first wrote to me to ask if we could do a little plug for the walk that you're planning. But Claire, if I can turn to you now and ask you, what's this big event that you've got coming up later in the year?
It's a walk, isn't it?
It's the Frontline Walk. So yeah, it's three different walks at the moment. Two of them are 100-kilometre walks over the battlefields of World War One and World War Two, and we've all got a new event, which is slightly different format. Instead of being 100 kilometers, it's a shorter walk, but it's at altitude. So it's in the Pyrenees Mountains, and they follow an old World War Two escape route from France into Spain.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really brilliant. It's our first year for that one, which we're really looking forward to. But the one we really want to focus on is the Normandy Walk. Obviously, your podcast focuses on World War Two, and
yes.
Normandy Walk follows the route of, well, it passes through the five landing beaches during D-Day. And it's will be our third year of doing the walk this year. Right. And it takes place in October.
And how many places have you got on it? How many people have been going?
We are hoping to get 100.
Right.
So the premise of the walk, when it first started back in 2014, it was to mark the centenary of World War One. And the idea was that you'd have 100 people walk 100 kilometres, you know, to commemorate the 100-year anniversary.
Yeah.
And since then, it's expanded from the Western Front Walk, obviously commemorating World War One, to the Normandy Walk, which is commemorating World War Two. So it's following that same format of 100, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And where does the walk actually start from, and where does it go to at the end?
The first day is kind of the British day. So we go from Marlborough Battery through to Pegasus Bridge and then Sword and Juno Beach. And then the next day is kind of the American day. So it focuses on the landing beaches of the Americans. So we go to Ironmark Memorial, Utah Beach. And then the last day is Omaha Beach, Gold Beach. And we finish at the British Normandy Memorial.
That's spectacular, the Normandy Memorial, isn't it? That's a new
yeah,
monument.
Yeah, it's relatively new, isn't it? Yeah. Steve's been twice now, I haven't got to see it myself yet, but yeah, this year I will be able to.
Now they've finished it all, honestly, it's absolutely fantastic. And to finish there after 3 days of long walking, you know, on foot, as you know, lots of people talk about the mechanized war, but there were many, many people on foot across these beaches, and
yes,
walking up, following in their footsteps is actually a really incredibly powerful moment. And to finish at the Normandy Memorial really is unlike anything else.
Something to look forward to finish.
Absolutely.
So you've done all the beaches basically. Have you got any particular landmarks en route that you're going to pay attention to, or the adventures of any particular people?
On the event, we have a historian that accompanies us, and called Steve Roberts, and he meets us at a number of the sites. And every time we've done the event, he finds new stories of incredible individuals that, and you're standing in the place where they fought, you're hiding, you know, crossing the corner that they crossed, or the tram stop where they hid.
Yeah.
You know, everyone from Sam Hollis through to, you know, Iron Mike and the amazing stories there. It's what I find amazing about the event is that each year we've done it, that people have had family connections and links to either members of their family or people that perhaps worked at the company they worked at or in the village they grew up in that landed on the beaches 80 years ago. And through the historian and some of the other participants who've got such a keen passion for the history, they're really able to find out incredible details about these individuals, and it really brings the whole story to life.
Yes.
You hear lots of huge numbers, it's difficult to comprehend, but when it's broken down into Peter from the village or David from the company back in the day, it's an amazing, it really brings it to life.
That certainly sounds like something to look forward to. So Claire, if somebody wants to join in on this event, what's the best way to go about it? Visit the website.
Yeah, they can visit our website at soldierscharity.org/frontline walk.
Okay. I'll put all those links in the episode notes so people can find them easily. So we'll try and send you a few customers, a few people to raid the beach as you walk along. So where are people staying overnight? Do you stop in at hotels and stuff? Or
yeah, we stay at a hotel close by.
Oh, so you stay in the one place and work around the area?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We get a coach out every morning, coach back every evening.
And how many miles do they walk roughly each day?
So 33 kilometres a day.
33, right.
So 20 so miles?
Something like that, isn't it? So it's not not too much.
No, it's a good challenge, but it's not. Like, for instance, the Yomp, as Steve mentioned earlier, that's 54 miles in 24 hours.
Right.
It's extremely difficult. Whereas a frontline walk, it's a good balance of challenging, but gives you enough time to actually appreciate where you're walking, have enough time to stop at the various points of interest.
Yeah. Oh, good. That sounds brilliant. So it's not going to be too strenuous. It'll just be a healthy walk each day, and just bring a few plasters with you in case you get any blisters, eh?
Yeah, definitely plasters. although it isn't too strenuous, we do still get a lot of blisters on the walk.
Do you? All right. Okay. Well, there's a warning then. Oh, gosh. I was going to go on in a minute to ask if there's any particularly interesting stories you want to cover, either from the people you've helped from the charity or, well, Steve, you've talked about individuals, haven't you? You mentioned Stan Hollis. But if there's any more.
I mean, there's an interesting story about one of the walkers who's done the Normandy walk. His name is Simon, and through a walk, he actually managed to retrace his father's footsteps. So his father wasn't in the army, he was in the Navy. He basically was part of the American landings. So although he was serving for the British Navy, he helped with command one of the landing crafts. And that was quite an incredible story. So Simon, the individual who took part in the walk, was able to go visit your beach. And our trip historian also got to go and interview Simon's father and just, again, build more about that connection.
Yes.
And Steve was able to kind of fill in a bit more gaps about the other side that Simon's dad perhaps didn't experience during the war. So there's just so many different stories that kind of span from it, and which our trip historian Steve is able to find out.
Yes. Wow, that sounds superb. That's going to be so exciting, I'm sure. How much is it going to cost?
So registration is £150.
Right.
But we do ask fundraisers to hit a £700 target by right. the end of July. And that essentially just covers all the charity's costs. So when people come on the trip, they will be looked after from the moment they arrive to depart to the moment they get back into London. So we all leave from London and we get a coach down to Normandy. It's quite a long way,
yes.
but it's worth it when yes. you get there. And you'll then have your accommodation covered and your food covered, any snacks on the break. You know, you'll get first aid support. And that's basically that £700 target. And then we ask overall that they raise £1,250.
Right. So it's 150 quid down as a charitable pledge, which covers yeah. everything for them. Nothing else to pay, except you're hoping that they'll raise a minimum of 750 from sponsorships, etc., and ideally 1250.
Yeah.
Well, I think what we'll say is if anybody is doing it and they want to be sponsored, and they want to drop me a line to say they're doing it, I'll give them a shout out on the podcast in some future days, perhaps nearer the time. I don't know if we'll get any Americans coming over, but there may be some Americans who, because I have quite a strong American listenership. And so if there's anybody coming over from America and they want to try and double up a visit to the country, or well, yeah, to the UK initially, but... and they want to go to France and join in on this, then that's an ideal opportunity to have a tailor-made schedule laid on, isn't it, by experts and good company, no doubt.
Yeah, you won't find a better, more welcoming group to come and join. Lots of people sign up as individuals, but by the end of the event, they really are just this huge gang that... have the most brilliant
yeah.
5 days and have memories that really do, you know, form the highlight of people's year.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right. There we go then. So that's October the what?
October the 4th to the 8th.
Yeah. October the 4th to the 8th. Links in the show notes and the episode for everything you've talked about. And you've got a great website, haven't you? Full of details about the event and about things you support, things you've done. So plenty to read. And you've got a podcast as well, haven't you?
Yes, yes. We've got a podcast called General Talk. And it's really interesting. It's lots of interviews and in conversations with a number of people, both within the serving military and retired. Some incredible stories and anecdotes from people that have done and experienced amazing things.
Yeah, well, that's excellent. Right, well, I've got two more things to do. I'll just say, Claire, thank you for getting in touch. It's been great to talk to you both. Steve, thanks for joining us as well. And I just wish you best of luck with your charity for the rest of the year, and particularly keep in touch with how subscriptions are going for your October event. Okay then, well, I say goodbye. Thanks again, lovely to see you both and speak to you both.
Have a wonderful Easter.
Thank you, Steve. Keep in touch.
Thank you.
Looking forward to hearing
bye-bye.
It
bye-bye.
Bye.
Claire and Steve from ABF, the Soldiers Charity. So that's soldierscharity.org/frontline walk, October the 4th to the 8th 2023. Setting off from London, staying in a hotel and covering all 5 beaches and much more with a pro historian and a great bunch of chaps and chapesses. Just take a large suitcase with you, That's for the plasters, folding walking stick and crutches, emergency care rations, and a tin of bully beef, just in case you get lost. That's a joke, by the way, all of it. Stacks of links in the show notes, on your listening app, and the website, soldierscharity.org/frontlinewalk. Many thanks for coming on the show, you two, and sharing all that information. Great stuff. So that's the Normandy Walk this year, and I guess future years. 5 beaches for the price of 1. How good is that? We're going to hear from veteran Ken Cook shortly, but I just want to share a few reviews and feedback first. And the following people kindly left show reviews in various places. Bryce Rathman on the website, he says, I'm a keen listener. I've been listening to the show since I was 9 and I'm currently 11 and an avid history buff. It was great, but I have a suggestion. You should do an episode on Easy Company, 2nd Battalion, 506 PIR or Band of Brothers. Hi Bryce, and thank you so much for your loyalty at such a young age. Regarding your suggestion to cover the Band of Brothers and Easy Company, etc., I would absolutely love to, but it depends upon me being sent a family story or memoir about it, because my show's really about unpublished history. So it's about real memoirs from real people, and I prefer not to cover war material unless I can include that. So if any listener has any family stories or anecdotes, please send them in. I do try to use every scrap of stories I'm sent, so don't write thinking it's going to disappear into a black hole. But Bryce, I've got a bit of a surprise for you, because at least this episode shortly, we're going to be covering Battalion 504 in the Parachute Infantry Regiment. So I hope that's a good substitute for what you actually wanted. We've got some pretty good letters from a veteran and stories that go behind the scenes. Bryce, thank you for writing in, and thanks for your interest and support. Listener Ken Muish from the USA. Ken, I don't know how to pronounce your surname. I'm so sorry. But you ran across the podcast a few weeks ago and you can't stop listening. Very interesting personal stories and memoirs from World War II. That's from Joho, 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 Ho Ho from the Netherlands. To her. Thank you, Joe. Last episode, Kisses. I'd like to share a little reflection on that last episode. Since that veritable cruise missile of a musical called Kisses on a Postcard blasted onto the show, I have been showered with feedback. Kisses on a Postcard with Dominic Frisby certainly seems to have pressed a few buttons with people. It's breaking a few records for listenership, with nearly 8,000 downloads to date and counting. And I don't think I've ever had so much feedback on an episode, so I'm going to share it with you. Wayne Howard from Norfolk, England, wrote in and said he was nearly put off listening to Kisses because he thought it was a soppy love story. Of course, Wayne did listen to it and suggested it should be called...
Have you got any gum, chum?
Wayne, I love that idea. Not a hope in hell of it being adopted, but I love it. Got any gum, chum? Needless to say, Wayne is now a fan. Of course, Kisses on a Postcard was about some young London children who were evacuated to Plymouth during the war, and it follows their story with the most wonderful and dramatic theatrical production this podcast could ever have hoped to feature. Root Schirmer from Holland echoed Wayne's comment about the type of show that this was going to be, but he got there in the end. He said, I started listening to it with mixed feelings. After all, I'm primarily interested in the military side of World War II. To my surprise, I got hooked, and I was unexpectedly moved by the story, especially the first part of it, when the Vakis leave their families. So, in short, what a great episode, and how well you mixed the interview with elements of the musical podcast. I enjoyed it so much. Thank you, Root, and shortly I'm going to share a story from you about all this. But first, to continue feedback, Derek Whittle wrote in to share his own insight into the fate of evacuees in other areas of Britain. Derek says, "My parents were from Hume by Manchester Docks. Mum went to a farm in Winsford, loved it. Dad was sent to a farm in Preston. His cousin was with him. The farmer's wife wouldn't let them inside the house. She saved all the nice cuts of meat for her own son. And Dad and his cousin got all the fat and scraps, which they were made to eat outside. Dad wouldn't complain. He said it must have been very hard for them to have little street urchins turn up like that. My Nana found out. She went to Preston and gave the farmer's wife a bash around the head with her handbag, and she brought him back to inner-city Manchester. He used to go hunting for shrapnel and recalls the barrage balloons in the street. Derek's dad was Alan Whittle, and he ended up being in the army, and he served 1951 to 53 in the Irish Guards. He did the Queen's father's funeral in London, as well as generally asked about in Germany with a Bren gun carrier for a few months. His mate got the RAF maintenance unit in Handforth and could walk home. I wish I listened more now as a kid, but you don't really envisage them not being there, do you?" Well, what an awesome photo Derek has sent in of his dad, resplendent in his great big black furry hat that's nearly as tall as a tall person. Apparently those hats are called bearskins, and each one is made from the fur of a Canadian black bear, and it's 18 inches tall with a red plume on one side. I've put a photograph of Derek's dad in the show notes. Derek, many thanks for the story and the photograph. Continuing feedback on the Kisses on a Postcard episode, Lisa Loftus from USA said, "I teared up so many times, and the story of the baby elephant melted me to a puddle. I want to thank you for that incredible episode." Jeff Mansour on Facebook said, "I enjoyed it very much." Frank Papalia and son James in the USA on the Facebook page said, "Paul, you weren't kidding when you said my kids would love it. They've been singing the songs. James thought it was funny when he said,
'You talk the jive, Clive?'
And the boy replies,
'My name's not Clive, it's Alan.'"
Oh, we had some laughs with that episode, didn't we? Wolfie Wolf from America said on Apple Podcasts, "Kisses was fantastic. I loved it. After I got home, I got on the YouTube to listen to it again. I hope someday this becomes a Broadway play or a movie. I hope Tom Hanks or Spielberg will hear about it." A final word from me on Kisses that impressed me most in that interview, apart from the whole thing, was what Dominic said about his passion.
"This is almost the most important thing I've ever done in my life."
And you know what, listener? If that was Dominic's opinion of one of his life's works, then he deserves every success with this venture. I, for one, will be first in line online for a ticket at the IMAX. Oppenheimer movie, eat your heart out. You know, I'm pretty proud of many of the episodes we've had on the Fighting Through podcast, but Kisses on a Postcard ranks at the top with the very best of them. Anyway, talking of accomplishments, to top all of this, I've got one more bit of news about Kisses, and that is that it recently won silver at the New York Festival's Radio Awards. So how good is that? Well done, Dominic. You've made me feel so proud of you. I hope they played the Kisses theme tune when you walked up to collect the award. A few more stories now about civilian bombings and punishments during the war. Tim Beersma from Holland. Tim's gone out of his way to script his own mini podcast episode for us. He starts off, "Hello, Paul. I've been listening to your podcast for more than a year now, and I'm almost up to date with all your episodes. Ever since I was young, I've been interested in the war. I blame my dad for that, since my bedtime stories were from his national service in the 80s, keeping the Russians away. I studied mechanical engineering, and I always managed to get my apprenticeship at companies that restored stuff. My final apprenticeship was at a company called BAIV, where we restored an A-34 Comet tank called Celerity. When she was done, we took her to the War and Peace Show, where they'd invited some World War II tank veterans along. And I can tell you, it's amazing how quickly an 80 or 90 year old can climb on a tank before before he realises that he's 90 years old and shouldn't be able to do that. Ever since this, I've had a big passion for British vehicles, and I now own a Norton 16H from 1942 and a Universal Carrier from 1941. The Norton I'm currently restoring, and I've just listened to episode 84, and it's given me some extra motivation to work on it." Listener, episode 84 was about Canadian Lance Corporal David Johnson. "The Carrier is in the shape of an Airfix kit, but a bit heavier. Might sell it. Yes, my girlfriend is very forgiving and lets me collect British tank parts in the living room." Oh. "So now for the main event," Tim says. "My late grandfather was in the war, but in a bit of a different way. Being Dutch and not in the army, he didn't play any big part in the fighting, but his tales of those times always amazed me. He didn't often talk about it, and when he did, he wouldn't sleep for a few days, so I never asked him about it. But sometimes he would tell stories, and I'll now try to tell them to you the best way I can. During the war, he lived in Amersfoort, and being of working age, he had to cycle to work every day. On his route to work, he had to cross a railway crossing. Sometimes this crossing was blocked by a train hauling cattle cars that had trouble hauling its human cargo over the hump, and a helper engine would have to come to push it on its way to wherever these poor people were heading. The next story he only told me about a year ago, and it's about him becoming a bombing target. During one of the days he was at home, he could hear the Allied bombers going over and the air raid warning. Hearing this, he ran down the stairs to the cellar. When he was in the doorway to the cellar, a bomb came straight through the front door, passed behind him, and exploded in the kitchen. The pressure wave of the bomb passing behind him had pushed him into the cellar and saved his life. Sadly, that wasn't the case for a lot of people, and there were quite a few people killed on the street. I'll spare you the details. The bombers had missed their target of the railway yard and had hit a residential area. So now he was in the cellar with a collapsed house on top of it. Somehow people realised there was someone left alive under there and they started to dig him out. But then the air raid warning went off again and they had to look for shelter themselves. This wouldn't have been a big problem for my granddad. He was in the cellar already, right? Well, the water main had also broken and the cellar was slowly filling up with water. Somehow they got him out in time and he only had a concussion. Now, being homeless, they had to find a place to stay. This was when my granddad said that there was a house of some NSB people, Dutch collaborators, that had left on Dollar Dinsdag to hide in Germany. Listener, Dollar Dinsdag, or Mad Tuesday, took place in the Netherlands on 5th of September 44, when celebrations were prompted after broadcasts alleged that Breda, in occupied Netherlands, had been liberated by Allied forces. In the event, it didn't properly happen for several more weeks, but the premature celebrations did cause panic in certain quarters. So the family went to the German officer in charge of Amos Fort and explained the story, and if it was possible for the family to move into that house for the time being. They pushed all the belongings of the NSB people into one room and lived in the rest of the house. At some point, my great-grandfather came up with the idea to look for the papers belonging to the collaborators to hand to the Allies after the liberation. This they did, and after the liberation of Amos Fort, they handed the papers to the police and the collaborators were arrested. After the war, their house was rebuilt and they lived there for many years. In 1946, my granddad was drafted for national service to go and liberate the Dutch East Indies. During his officer's training, he fell off a swinging rope on the assault course, which gave him his second concussion. As a result, he was medically discharged from the army and was spared another war. When he passed away last summer, we found a small medal belonging to my great-grandfather, commemorating his part in the Dutch railway strike on the 17th of November 1944 to support Operation Market Garden and delay German supplies reaching the front lines. I never felt so proud of my family. They actually had a part in our liberation, however small it was. Bye-bye for now, Tim Biersma. Tim, thank you so much for that. It was very timely. But you didn't leave a PS. Well, I'll provide a PS. Here it is, coincidentally from Ruud Schirmer. Here in occupied Netherlands, a food crisis emerged after the Allied armies liberated the south. Especially in the western urbanised regions, this resulted in outright starvation of the population during the winter of 1945. Food droppings by RAF Bomber Command and 8th US Air Force. But before that, the Dutch authorities came up with a plan to evacuate kids from the cities to the countryside. This was permitted by the Germans. It resulted in, I guess, similar situations as described in the Kisses episode, but I don't think that there was an auction on arrival. Also, the duration was a lot shorter, of course, as it took place at the end of the war. The children stayed until a couple of months after war's end. And yes, also, as Dominic described, mixed experiences, great times versus abuse and submission, etc. The evacuation of undernourished city kids even continued for a while after the end of the war, as the starvation in the West went on until the very moment of capitulation of the Germans in Netherland. And to complete this, quite a few Jewish kids were snatched from the Germans when the Jewish population were rounded up for deportation during the earlier phases of the occupation. There were various active networks to take the kids and add them to families in the countryside as extended members of their hosting family. It must have been heartbreaking for the parents, who usually had an inkling of their own fate. I met a few of these kids over the years through their kids. Many had been traumatized for having survived. Treatment by their host was mixed as well. The Netherlands countryside was very religious, so you can imagine that Jewish kids were often forced to convert and adopt the local Protestant culture. Also, for their own safety, in order to blend in with their new social environment. As for the spirit you mention, as a side thing, I've always been intrigued, for lack of a better word, by the interaction of US GIs and the English population. It seems to come out nicely in the musical podcast. There are some elements of it in the series Band of Brothers, and the film Yanks with Richard Gere and William Devane is completely about that during the months running up to D-Day. Ruud, thank you so much for that contribution. Another Britain being bombed story now from regular contributor Derek Whittle. He's dug out a story of an incident which his own mum was witness to in July 1942. I'm featuring it now because it relates so well to what was going on in Britain, well beyond the boundaries of London, where obviously so much bombing took place during the infamous Blitz earlier in the war. It rather makes you think whether or not the evacuation of children was pointless because so many areas of Britain got bombed, and here's just one of them. Derek introduces the story. There was an incident in the Derbyshire area of England that my mother often spoke about. It was a playing field, I believe, but how terrifying it must have been for the village. And this is from the Great British Life online magazine. There's a link in the show notes. And the headline here is "The Story Behind the Luftwaffe's Attack on New Mills." The day the sleepy villages of New Mills and Hayfield faced up to a terrifying and unexpected foe, two German bombers. During World War II, few areas of the UK were spared from Luftwaffe bombing. The high peak of Derbyshire was no exception. Most were the result of German air crews jettisoning unused bombs as they fled home. But on the Friday evening of 3rd of July 42, a daring raid wreaked havoc on two innocent high peak villages which had to that point been spared the terrors of war. Two Junkers Ju-88 high-speed bombers had set off low level from their base in Brittany, a region in the far west of France, to bomb a propeller factory near Bolton in the northwest of England. The route had taken them across the English Channel and up the Irish Sea before turning inland. Cloud cover was lower than expected, and they couldn't find the propeller factory. With low fuel reserves, they had no time to search, so they set off back to their landing destination in Amsterdam. As with most German bombing raids in the northwest of England, the shortest route was across Derbyshire and Lincolnshire to the safety of the North Sea. So it was for these two still fully laden bombers. They were spotted over areas of Manchester and Stockport, and for an unknown reason, as they approached New Mills, they banked round to the northeast. At 8 p.m, two aircraft came screaming up the River Goyt, machine guns blazing. There was no air raid warning. One flew over New Mills centre, dropping two high explosive bombs in Tor Vale. The other took a wider arc and dropped two bombs near to Swizzle's sweet factory. Although there was considerable damage, there were only minor injuries. The planes sped up Set Valley, continuing to fire machine guns as they flew over New Mills cricket ground, where a cup match was in progress between New Mills and Hayfield schools. The sportsmaster shouted to hit the deck. Luckily, nobody was injured. As the terrified children ran for home, the planes dropped more bombs nearby in the Low Leighton area. An old Victorian workhouse in use as an infirmary was narrowly missed, but two stone cottages known as Whitfield Villas and a small Wesleyan chapel were destroyed. The family of one of the cottages was out for a meal, but in the other was 79-year-old Mrs. Gillies, her 18-year-old grandson, Morris Handford, and 10-year-old granddaughter, Joan Handford, who'd stayed home to practice piano. Rescue services were quickly on site. Mrs. Gillies and Morris were trapped beneath rubble and seriously injured. Sadly, Joan had been killed. Adjacent to the cottages, sat in his allotment behind the chapel, reading a book, caretaker Daniel McKellar was also injured after being hit by bullets and debris. After first aid, he was rushed to hospital, but died the following day. In New Mills, there were reports of 10 others injured and 150 reports of damage to property. The planes continued to Hayfield, firing their machine guns. As they flew over the recreational ground, they released more bombs. Three stone cottages on Springvale Road were obliterated. Reports tell of a lack of panic and hysteria. The Home Guard, Special Police and the Civil Defence Services were soon on site. Sadly, there were six fatalities, which included Frieda Thorpe, a 10-year-old evacuee from Manchester. Leaving Hayfield devastated, the planes climbed over Kinder Scout, veered to the southeast and re-established their heading towards Holland. As they passed Stony Middleton, they dropped the last of their bombs at Darlton Quarry before strafing Chatsworth House as they made good their escape. The sector controller immediately scrambled four interceptors from the RAF base at Curtin in Lindsay, 20 miles north of Lincoln. Based there were Spitfires of 303 Polish Squadron, arguably the most famous fighter squadron of all time. They'd scored the highest number of kills in the Battle of Britain 2 years previously. Their commander was squadron leader Jan Zumbach, an enigmatic, highly decorated and famous Battle of Britain pilot. Flight sergeants Funcher and Popek were airborne first, joined us about 8:10 p.m. by pilot officer Konecki and sergeant Rockin... I tried. Sergeant Rocket Nicky. Cloud cover was still very low, but they soon spotted the two German aeroplanes 2 miles east of Lincoln, flying at 0 feet, heading east in close formation. Wünscher attacked first, causing the German aircraft to separate. One broke to the north, chased by Wünscher, and Popek firing their machine guns and cannons. It was soon ablaze and crashed, killing all four crew members. Popek then joined Konecki and Rocket Nicky in attacking the second Junker, setting its starboard engine on fire and causing it to crash land in a cornfield. The crew surrendered and were arrested by the local Home Guard. It was significantly the 178th enemy aircraft attributed to 303 Squadron, from which they collected several artifacts, including iron crosses, machine guns, and a piece of the tail fin, which they later adorned with details of the event and used it in many World War II publicity photographs. There's a link, there's a picture in the show notes. That story continues, but if you want to read the full version of it, there's a link in the show notes. So just to recap, that article was from Great British Life Online magazine. Back in episode 79, I featured a song by Australian Nick Faint, Song for the Bad Guys, and looking back, I feel I slightly shortchanged him because I only played the instrumental in the background, and his full vocal version was right at the end of the podcast, so a lot of people may have missed it, despite the warnings about the PS. Anyway, as penance, here goes with a repeat of the full version of this Song for the Bad Guys from Nick's Next Exit from Babylon album. And there's a link to all of Nick's material in the show notes. And I hear he's also got a new song out called Coming Up Roses. Links to everything in the show notes. This is Nick Faint.
I was a boy, I used to play with plastic soldiers, green and grey. Grey's for bad and green's for good, this I understood. 'Cause the good guys are so squeaky clean, you know they'd never do anything mean. And all those folks they've blown to smithereens should be grateful to be blown up for such a good cause and be on TV in those good guys' wars. Even if it's only in small parts. And there'll be no grieving when the bad guys are leaving to that inferno down below, where everyone knows the bad guys go. none of the bad guys' mums ever held them in their arms when they were babies and loved them like crazy. No, that's just not how it goes. And none of the bad guys' sons lost their fathers much too young and spent their lives dreaming of vengeance when they should be outside having fun in the sun. And it doesn't matter how many bad guys, in inverted commas, that you blow up with your great big bombers. It doesn't take a NASA rocket scientist to be knowing there can be no peace while the well of grief is full to overflowing. Tell me just what you expect to achieve while the body count keeps growing. After all those years, you're still wondering why. Cast as a bad guy. And everybody said the war to end all wars was the one before yours. And how many times can we say that we've learned? This will be the very last self-righteous cause. When you mix black and white, you'll only come up with blood red. And there's so many ripples of grief that spread out from every act of bloodshed. There can be no peace while the well of grief is full to overflowing. There can be no peace while the well of grief is full to overflowing. Peace while the well of grief is full to overflowing.
Chris Canfield from Canada wrote in to say that the two recent episodes about Alf Blackburn have been absolutely terrific. That's episodes 89 and 90. My father and I drove up to a cabin north of snowy Ottawa this past weekend while listening to Alf's memories, and we both enjoyed them immensely. I've now gone and ordered a copy of the book for myself. Cheers. Thanks, Chris. It's a nice scene you've drummed up there. Cozy, warm pickup cabin, snow belting down, and a double podcast episode to listen to. If anyone wants a copy of Alf's book, there's a link at the very top of the homepage for a while. After that, just check out the show notes and website, always. Brian McFeeters just signed up for Patreon. Thank you, Brian. He said he's been a long-time listener to the podcast and just finished Dad's book, which he enjoyed immensely. Gabrielle Cervantes from Appleton, Wisconsin, has brought me several Norman de Calvados on the Buy Me a Coffee feature. Love the show, Paul, says Gabriel. Gabriel, I'm sorry I missed the timing for your prompt you gave me for quite a good YouTube series to watch on D-Day, but any time's a good time to listen to D-Day stuff. And you gave me a D details of a dedicated channel for Time Ghost Histories, 24-hour coverage of D-Day as it really happened. And that's two guys talking through it like it was news happening right now, analysing the strategies and situations. So there's a link for that in the show notes. Andy S. from Seaford in East Sussex has also bought me some Normandy Calvados. Thank you, Andy. Gary Rose has also bought me 5 Normandy Calvadoses, saying that the stories of these brave boys have inspired me to find out my uncle's own stories. Thank you, all you guys, all of you. And of course, if you uncover any great family history, get in touch through the contact page on the website. Gord Allard from Canada says that I've been listening to the podcast for a while now while I'm walking the dog, and the time goes by very quickly because some episodes are so interesting. We sometimes end up going a bit further just to get to the end of the story. My grandfather was in the RCAF, that's Royal Canadian Air Force, as a mechanic, and a lot of great uncles were in the Navy. Gord, thanks for that. I'm just picturing your poor little dog dragging its sorry backside through the woods as you insist on just one more episode. Oh, Dad, it's saying. And there we have the fanfare for the main event of the show. Here goes. This is a contribution inspired by Dave Thomas's father, and if any of 82nd Airborne, 504th Parachute Infantry, Sicily or Italy, get your pulses racing, listen in. Dave Thomas reviewed the show on the website. Absolutely the best World War II podcast available. Good man, Dave. Like Bill Cheel, my father also experienced the hell of combat and the death of close friends and comrades. I am in Oregon, USA, and my father, Fred Thomas, was in H Company, 504th Parachute Infantry, 82nd Airborne. He was in North Africa before making his first combat jump during Operation Husky in Sicily, July the 9th, 1943. He was on one of the first planes in the invasion, and only half the guys made it out before the plane went down. When they jumped, it was in gale force winds at less than 400 feet. He landed in an olive orchard, which we found in 1998 when I took him back to Sicily and Italy. I have many of his letters written to my grandparents from Sicily and Italy. It took me more than 20 years to get my father to open up about his experience. He passed in 2002 at the age of 92 and had nightmares until he died. Here's one of the stories that might interest you. In 2015, my wife and I travelled to Italy along the Amalfi coast. I was there to meet Aldo Cinque, a retired geology professor from Agarola near Amalfi. I'd been trying to locate an old tunnel that my father's company had been defending near Salerno. The Italians withdrew from the war the day before the invasion, but the Allies landed in an area defended by German troops. They were outnumbered 10-1 and held it for 10 days with small arms. His company received the Presidential Unit Citation for their action. Aldo knew where the tunnel was, and we were able to visit the location. It was exactly like my dad had said. The locals don't like to spend much time there because it's like a dead zone. No birds, animals or sounds. Very strange indeed. When I gave Aldo an old photograph that my dad had of himself and his buddies taken near Pompeii, he looked at it and said, "I know who took that photo. It was my father." I was shocked. Turns out his father was born in the USA and spoke better English than Italian. He was working with Italian archaeologists photographing excavations in Pompeii. That's why I remembered my dad saying that the person who took the photo was an Italian guy who spoke good English. and that's why they agreed to have him take it in return for sea rations. It's a small world. Paul, thank you for sharing your father's experiences. My dad said he came across some British soldiers, Limeys, when he was in Sicily. He said they were great guys and very friendly, although he couldn't understand why they took time for tea in the middle of a battle. I suppose the same reason the American guys took time for coffee. Warm regards, Dave Thomas, Wilsonville, Oregon, USA. Dave, thanks for your kind sponsorship on Patreon and for your family's story. We dug a bit deeper here, and Dave sent me some more stories together with some of his dad's letters home. Before I share these, just a bit of background about the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment. This information is on the 504th website and also in Wikipedia. Links in the show notes. On 29th of April 1943, the 504th boarded the troop ship USS George Washington, which steamed to North Africa, and the regiment's first overseas port of call, Casablanca. They arrived shortly before the end of the campaign in North Africa, which ended with the surrender of almost 250,000 Axis soldiers. Upon arrival, the paratroopers marched 8 miles south of the city, where they set up a garrison area consisting of a few stone huts and a tent city. Soon, the regiment was moved by 40s and 8s northwards to Oujda, Morocco. The 40s and 8s were railroad cars dating from World War I, so called because they were designed to carry 40 men or 8 horses. Training intensified, and senior officers such as General Eisenhower and Lieutenant General Patton, along with the Sultan of Morocco and officials of every allied nation, watched the 504th go through its paces. Training included many practice jumps, and one conducted in winds of up to 30 miles an hour put nearly 30% of the unit in the hospital with broken bones, sprains and bruises. Finally, the order came and the 504th moved by truck to Kairouan in Tunisia, which was to be the 82nd Airborne Division's point of departure for the Allied invasion of Sicily. Colonel James M. Gavin, commander of the 505th Parachute Regimental Combat Team, with the 3rd Battalion of the 504th attached, led the 82nd Airborne during Operation Husky, and on the night of 9th of July 1943, the 504th helped spearhead the Allied invasion of Sicily in the first airborne military offensive in the history of the United States Army. So that's why everyone was interested in the training. The paratroopers of the 504th crossed over the Sicilian coast on schedule. Despite extensive precautions to avoid an incident near the Sicilian coast, a nervous Allied naval vessel suddenly fired upon the formation. Immediately, all of the naval vessels and shore troops joined in, downing friendly aircraft and forcing plane loads of paratroopers to exit far from their intended drop zones in one of the greatest friendly fire tragedies of World War II. However, US Navy ships had been under intense Axis aerial attacks, and many were unaware of the impending jump. 23 planes were destroyed, 37 were damaged, and almost 400 casualties were confirmed. Colonel Tucker's plane, after twice flying the length of the Sicilian coast, and with well over 2,000 holes in its fuselage, finally reached the drop zone near Gela. By morning, only 400 of the rest of the regiment's 1,600 paratroopers had reached the objective area. The others had been dropped in isolated groups on all parts of the island and carried out demolitions, cut lines of communication, established island roadblocks, ambushed German and Italian motorised columns and caused so much confusion over such an extensive area that initial German radio reports estimated the number of American parachutists dropped to be over 10 times the actual number. 3 days after landing, on 13th of July 43, the 504th Parachute Infantry moved out, spearheading the 82nd Airborne Division's drive northwest, 150 miles along the southern coast of Sicily. With captured Italian light tanks, trucks, motorcycles, horses, mules, bicycles and even wheelbarrows pressed into service, the 82nd encountered only light resistance and took 22,000 prisoners of war in their first contact with enemy forces. Overall, the Sicilian operation proved costly, both in lives and equipment, but the regiment gained valuable fighting experience and managed to hurt the enemy in the process. So that's the background, and we're going back in time to Africa now for a moment. So this is one of Fred's letters home, and this is before the Sicily adventure. May the 20th, 1943, from Africa. And date-wise, this would have been after the Battle of Wadi Akarit in Tunisia and just before the invasion of Sicily a few weeks later. I think Fred would have been resting up in Tunisia at this point. Dear folks, I have a little time, so I'll drop you a line. We took a long train trip through North Africa about a week ago. I sure did see a lot of the country. These people are a lot different than they are in the States. We also saw many German prisoners. We passed several trainloads of them. We saw and talked to a lot of French soldiers. Andy Brombach is in C Company. I saw him on the boat, but I haven't seen him since. I've only received one letter from you since I got here. Write often, Fred. And then a few weeks later on June the 7th, also from Africa, Fred says, well, I still haven't received an answer to any of the letters I wrote since I've been in Africa. It sure has been hot here. It gets hot in the daytime and cool at night. It hasn't rained once since I've been here. It's just dusty and dirty. Water is rationed. We sleep outside in pop tents. They're little tents with just room enough for two of us to sleep in. We sleep on the ground. It was tough at first, but we're getting used to it now. Donald Thomas is in the hospital. He's been injured and thinks he'll be back in a week or so. Hope everyone at home is okay. Write soon, Fred. Dave adds that his dad was in Oujda training and then flew out of Kairouan in Tunisia for Sicily. His unit didn't see any combat in Tunisia. Dad hated North Africa. It was so hot and dirty. Over to 1943 Sicily now. Dave says, the first wave of paratroopers was mostly the 505 Parachute Infantry Regiment, commanded by the youngest general in the US Army, James Gavin. My dad was in the 504th PIR H Company, attached to the 505 on the night of July the 9th, before the remainder of the 504th jumped the next day. Unfortunately, the second wave was hit by naval friendly fire and more than 20 planes went down, killing most of the paratroopers on them. One of my dad's funny stories about the war was about General Patton, who was in Tunis before they boarded the C-47s the night of the 9th. Just as Dad was climbing up the ladder to board the plane, General Patton said, "Boys, I wish I was going in your place." Dad responded, "General, I wish you were too." The guy behind him pushed him so hard into that C-47, while the general had a puzzled look on his face. I'm attaching a photo of him and some of the guys in his platoon who took out a German tank in Sicily on July the 10th or 11th. Dad is on the barrel holding his rifle. I've put that photograph in the show notes. Turning to the history records of the Sicily operation, I'm now going to refer to the 505 Parachute Infantry Regiment website. And this is what they say about the invasion, codenamed Husky. And this was the backdrop to the mission provided by Colonel Gavin, the overall commander. Our jump is to take place in moonlight, the night of July the 9th. It's clear that the effort will be a very risky one, and a costly one. It is nonetheless a typical parachute operation, Colonel James M. Gavin. The bivouac atmosphere remained businesslike and grim. No horseplay, no heroics, no boasts, no doubts. The Yanks were ready and confident. The tenseness mounted as the time grew short. Trucks carried all units to the various airfields and the waiting C-47s. Assigned planes were located, identified by a chalk number on the side, and all required equipment was secured. Parachutes were tried on and adjusted. The password of George, with the response of Marshall, was told to the men, with the advice that they better know the password because there are going to be a lot of itchy trigger fingers. And a slip of paper with a message from Colonel Gavin was handed out to each trooper, and this would have included Dave's dad. Soldiers of the 505 Parachute Combat Team, tonight you embark upon a combat mission for which our people and the free people of the world have been waiting for 2 years. You will spearhead the landing of an American force upon the island of Sicily. Every preparation has been made to eliminate the element of chance. You have been given the means to do the job, and you are backed by the largest assemblage of air power in the world's history. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of every American go with you. Since it's our first flight at night, you must use the countersign and avoid firing on each other. The bayonet is the night fighter's best weapon. Conserve your water and ammunition. The term American parachutist has become synonymous with courage of a high order. Let us carry the fight to the enemy and make the American parachutist feared and respected through all his ranks. Attack violently. Destroy him wherever found. I know you will do your job. Good landing, good fight, and good luck, Colonel Gavin. Back now to Fred's Sicily letters. This one's July the 30th, so this was well after the invasion. And he says, "Guess you wonder why you haven't heard from me for so long. This is the first chance I've had to write since I landed on Sicily. I made my first combat jump about midnight, July the 9th. Listener, wow. So at that same instant, Dad was getting on his ship for his part in the invasion of Sicily. I was among the first to land here. I can't tell you what I've been doing since then, but I suppose you've been reading the papers. We flew here from a base near Tunis. I think I like it here more than Africa. The people are very friendly to us. They hate Mussolini and the Germans as much as we do. They say they've been waiting for us for years. Mussolini has taken just about everything the people have here. About all they have is a lot of good wine. Hope you haven't worried about me too much. There were times when I was kind of worried myself, but I'm lucky enough to be alive and safe now. I would love to know what they had to say about us in the newspapers. Send me a few of the clippings if you have any. We should start getting our mail soon. I suppose I've got a lot of it back in Africa. They have a lot of fruit in this country. They sure raise a load of grapes. I think every family has a lot of wine, but that's about all they do have. The buildings and towns are all very old. Some of them look like they're about 1,000 years old. The streets are so narrow that cars and trucks can't pass. Hope you're all well. Write soon, Fred. Listener, a comment from me. It's interesting to read that he dropped late at night before the invasion the next morning. It's a nice bit of history there. And it's also interesting that they flew direct to Sicily from Tunisia. Dad had to go by lorry across the coastal desert roads, a journey that took about 3 weeks to get to Port Said in Egypt, from where they sailed to Sicily on the HMT Orontes. Another story from Dave about his father. When Dad was in Sicily, they were checking a farmhouse for Germans, but only found an Italian farmer in the cellar. They also found the cellar full of wine and grabbed several bottles to drink. The farmer made the sounds psst, psst, while grabbing his crotch and a bottle. He was trying to tell us that the Germans had peed in the wine when they were there. That's when Dave Rosencrantz popped the cork, took a drink, and said, "Sure doesn't taste like it." Dad would always tell that story, and it's the funny stories that these combat veterans would remember. Here's one final letter that Dave wrote when he was in Sicily, 31st of July. "Well, I received 4 letters from you today. It's the first mail I've received since I left Africa. Sure was glad to hear from you. I guess you've received my other letters by now and know that I was in the invasion of Sicily. We've sure gone through a lot since we jumped here. We were the first troops on the island. I came through it all without a scratch. Guess I'm lucky to be alive and safe now. We're just taking it easy and resting up now. Right often. Fred." Okay, Fred's next scenario is in Italy, and at this point I'm going to take a break and continue in the next episode. And here's a taster of what's still to come. Fred pulled the pin on a grenade to throw into the house. For some reason he paused. The field hospital was hell on earth. Screaming, wounded men.
25 yards down the road, the tank flew out and onto the road, and it must have bounced about 2 foot.
A bomb landed near me and blew me about 3 feet off the ground. Stand at ease, Sergeant.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.